From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project.
Live from NPR studios at Bryant Park in Midtown Manhattan, this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. News and information for your Monday morning. Hey, I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Allison Stewart. It is March 3rd, 2008, and I would hate to be somebody running for president today. Can you imagine what a tense day this must be?
No, do these people
Barack
eat?
Obama,
stomach ache.
Hillary Clinton, even John McCain. I mean, just what is at stake tomorrow? It's unbelievable to think that tomorrow could be a make-or-break day for likely the Democrats. John McCain kind of has it sewed up. But you wonder about all that money that they've raised. What are they using it for? And if you don't get the nomination, where does that money go?
Where does it go? Party.
I don't think that's allowed.
But we'll ask somebody.
There might be some rules governing it.
We'll ask somebody who knows about those kind of things.
Also, we're going to talk about China. China's in the news for its one-child-only policy. The country is thinking about raising that limit to two. This is a law. It's been in place for more than 30 years. There have been some it's worked to a certain degree. The population has shrunk, but there have been some negative consequences of that law as well. We're going to talk to the Newsweek correspondent in Beijing about that story.
And a couple set off from New York Harbor for not for a three-hour tour, but for a 1,000-day voyage. Have you ever sailed? Do you like to sail?
I get seasick.
Oh, no.
I know.
I have to sit right in the middle of the boat, and I can't really look at the water. But it's fun if you don't do that, I guess.
I love to sail. I've gone sailing with my dad since I was a little kid. But 1,000 days on a boat, I don't care how big that boat is. Well, this couple set out to break this record. On day 315, one of them had to bail. She will join us. She is freshly back on land for the first time in almost a year.
And these people, I thought the story was that they, you know, whatever, you're on the boat most of the time, you go and you dip into little islands.
No. They want to stay at sea. First, though, we're going to get your block of news for this Monday morning. Russia has a new president, and his name is... His name is, I'm going to try this one, Dmitry Medvedev.
Yes!
Thank you.
Dmitry Medvedev.
Thank you, Voice of America pronunciation guide. Vladimir Putin's chosen successor won more than 70% of the vote, and that's according to the country's Central Election Commission. But independent election monitors say there are reports of rigged polls. NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer is in Moscow with more.
Thousands of Dmitry Medvedev's supporters cheered at a rock concert in Red Square organized by the Kremlin in the pouring rain.
Привет, Россия! Привет, Москва!
When Medvedev sauntered out from the Kremlin's gates to address the crowd together with Putin, the new leader said his massive victory meant Russia would continue following Putin's policies. Putin has said he wants to remain on the scene as prime minister, and it's not clear how much power President Medvedev will have. Later at a news conference, Medvedev said he, not the prime minister, would set the country's foreign policy. Opposition leaders were barred from running in the election, in which observers said the authorities forced people to vote for Medvedev.
That was NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer reporting. And the Russians may have it all sealed up, but the presidential race here at home is still chugging along. We are less than a day away from another big round of primaries.
Barack Obama spent this weekend urging voters not to buy into Senator Clinton's promises that she could bring change. At a rally in Providence on Saturday, he highlighted Clinton's position on NAFTA.
A real change, for example, is not calling NAFTA a victory and saying how good it was for the American people until you decide to run for president. Like Senator Clinton did, that's not real change.
Obama also responded to a new ad by the Clinton campaign that suggests he does not have the experience to handle a crisis.
What precise foreign policy experience makes her prepared to answer that phone call at 3 in the morning?
Clinton was also in Ohio yesterday, where she continued to paint Obama as a candidate who talks pretty but lacks substance.
I don't want to be one of these people running for office. Oh, you know, and I come and
You got the bright lights and all the cameras, and I give you this big old speech, and everybody feels good, and you walk out, and you turn to your neighbor, and you say, well, that was beautiful, but what did it mean?
Clinton also took aim at Republican John McCain and his economic policy. Here she is in Austintown, Ohio.
We can't continue on the path we're on. That's one of the big differences between my friend and colleague, Senator McCain, and myself. He says he doesn't know much about the economy, except he wants to continue Bush policies.
On the Republican side, Mike Huckabee spent much of the weekend campaigning in Texas. And funny thing, the Dallas Morning News endorsing Huckabee. Senator John McCain going the low-profile route, sort of. He went back to his weekend cabin just outside Sedona, Arizona on Sunday afternoon, did a little grilling for some 36 reporters, staff members, and a few Republican friends from the Senate. Back to the trail today for him. He will hold a town hall meeting today in Waco, Texas. Tomorrow, all of the candidates face primaries in Vermont, Rhode Island, Ohio, and Texas.
This is NPR.
In Obama's home state today, a jury will be selected in a big corruption trial. Illinois real estate developer Antoine Tony Rezko is accused of bribes, kickbacks, and, quote, efforts to illegally obtain millions of dollars.
Rezko and Barack Obama had some personal real estate dealings, which have come up in the campaign. Here's NPR's Cheryl Corley with more on Tony Rezko.
He used to be a man that politicians like to see coming. Real estate developer and fast food tycoon Tony Rezko long had a reputation as being a gracious guy and a great fundraiser whose contributions went to both Republicans and Democrats. In Illinois, it was primarily Democrats, including the state's governor, Rod Blagojevich, and U.S. Senator Barack Obama. Senator Hillary Clinton has blasted Obama for his purchase of land next to his home from Rezko, since it had been widely reported before the sale the developer was being investigated. Even Obama has called the land deal a boneheaded mistake. Clinton appeared in a photograph with Rezko but received no donations from him. And Cindy Canary, the head of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, says the Rezko trial puts the Obama-Rezko relationship back in the spotlight.
There are no links that we know of that say there was any kind of quid pro quo with Obama and Rezko, but this can't help the senator.
Tony Rezko stands accused of using his political clout to run a multi-million dollar extortion scheme in the spring of 2004. Prosecutors say his goal was to collect bogus fees from companies hoping to handle investments from a teacher's pension fund and other state boards. When U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald announced the indictment more than a year ago, he said Rezko was a leader in a pay-to-play scheme on steroids.
When people are talking about getting $1.3 million each out of one deal, they're going to get $250,000 out of another deal. They're going to get a $1 million bribe out of another deal. The amounts of money that were being shaken down in 1 8-week span was in the millions.
Fitzgerald says those extortion plans were thwarted by federal investigators and that Rezko pocketed no more than $250,000. In court papers, an anonymous beneficiary of the alleged scheme is listed as only public official A. But federal judge Amy St. Eve, who will hear the Rezko case, recently identified public official A as Illinois' current governor, Rod Blagojevich. Prosecutors say Rezko became a powerful operative in state government because he raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for the governor. Blagojevich has not been charged with any wrongdoing, and this past week he had little to say about the case.
I don't know much about it. I have a job to do as governor, and it's a full-time job. I don't think it's fair for me to comment on a pending court case.
This is a big deal in Illinois, where we just sent our last governor to jail.
As Cindy Canary notes, it was just 3 months ago that the state's former governor, George Ryan, began serving a 6.5-year term for his conviction on corruption charges. Meantime, Barack Obama gave to charity the nearly $150,000 Rezko-linked contributions he received. Again, Cindy Canary.
I'm not expecting to see anything in the Rezko trial that really is damaging to the senator. This is very much a case about Illinois and about the executive administration and governor of the state of Illinois.
But Canary says in a hot political presidential race, anything can be damaging.
That's NPR's Cheryl Corley reporting.
It was a bloody weekend in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The violence started late on Friday when a suicide bomber killed 35 people and wounded 50 at a funeral in northwestern Pakistan's Swat Valley. On Saturday, three people were killed by a roadside bomb in eastern Afghanistan along Pakistan's border. And yesterday, a suicide bomber blew himself up during a meeting of thousands of tribal members in northwest Pakistan. 40 were killed. The tribal leaders were gathered to discuss resistance to al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
All these attacks are being attributed to a resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan. They're part of a growing worry in Washington about the future of that country and the NATO-led military mission. One recent report said Afghanistan is in danger of becoming a failed state. But even though prospects look bleak, military leaders point to one bright spot, the American-led counterinsurgency effort in the eastern part of the country. Here's NPR's Tom Bowman.
More than 12,000 American troops are spread over a dozen Afghan provinces, hard against the border with Pakistan, in what is known as Regional Command East. It's one of the few parts of Afghanistan where things seem to be improving. That's what Defense Secretary Robert Gates told Congress recently.
January was the first month to the eastern region of Afghanistan. It was the first month in 2 years where the level of violence was actually less than it was 2 years ago. It's our area of responsibility, and the counterinsurgency is going very well there.
Besides a large number of U.S. troops, tens of millions of American dollars are being poured into this region. That's giving the people of eastern Afghanistan more basic services. And at the same time, local councils are slowly taking over more responsibility for governing.
The Afghan citizens are noticing these improvements.
Major General David Rodriguez is the commander there. He told reporters at the Pentagon that recent surveys show a sense among the population that better days are ahead.
And half the population expresses satisfaction with the ability of medical care, drinking water, and education, which were all very, very low before.
That's not to say all is well in eastern Afghanistan. There are kidnappings, nests of Taliban fighters. Many Afghans still fear to even drive through this region to reach the city of Kandahar in the south. But General Dan McNeil, the top commander of the NATO-led mission in Afghanistan, says this eastern region is farther along than the southern part of Afghanistan, where Canadian troops are in the lead and attacks are on the rise.
That's not a derisive comment about anybody or anything, certainly not members of the alliance. It's just that clearly the U.S. has put the effort into making this piece of it right. And the counterinsurgency there, the term used by many NATO allies is we've got to be more comprehensive.
Comprehensive begins with longer tours. Americans serve 15 months on the ground compared to 6 months for most other NATO troops. That longer time allows the Americans to build closer ties with the locals. American troops also have more training in counterinsurgency, McNeil says. That means not only how to shoot, but how to rebuild, work with local officials, and American forces are flush with money for reconstruction.
That's NPR's Tom Bowman. His entire report is on our website. All this week, NPR is taking a look at the war in Afghanistan. Follow the series and read a report co-authored by retired Marine General Jim Jones on prospects for Afghanistan. Head over to our website for the link, npr.org/Bryant Park.
Now, Prince Harry is back in the U.K. after a tour of duty on the front lines in Afghanistan. It was a well-kept secret by the government and some mainstream media outlets. He sat for his first face-to-face interview at Norton Air Force Base in Oxfordshire on Saturday. The British press splashed his picture across the front pages, some calling him a hero, a title he declined.
No, I wouldn't say I'm a hero. There's guys who, you know, two injured guys who came back on the plane with us who were essentially comatose throughout the whole way. One who'd lost two limbs, a left arm and a right leg, and another guy who was basically saved by his mate's body being in the way and took shrapnel to the neck. Both out cold throughout the whole of the flight, and you know, those are the heroes.
Prince Harry's secret six-month deployment was cut short after the Drudge Report published details about where he was in Afghanistan.
Bryant Park is always online at npr.org/Bryant Park. And if you've been following the blog, you know that human Iditarodder, did you know that's a word? Jill Homer, she finished the 350-mile race in Alaska on Saturday. Her time was 6 days, 2 hours, and 20 minutes. Every minute counts in this. We caught up with her in Anchorage for the post-race lowdown.
There's one part of the trail that goes up a waterfall. It's this really slick stretch of ice, 5 or 6 degrees. You know, a pretty steep pitch to walk up glare ice. The wheels from under my bike that I was pushing alongside washed out, and the bike pulled me down with it. And as it was doing this, I kind of wrenched my right hip and pulled the muscle in the flexor. And then I fell over, and then my bike and I slid down the waterfall like 20 feet. And it wasn't a serious injury, but it was painful.
Yeah, seriously, that's a lot of pain. But you made it, and you can hear our interview with Jill on our blog, npr.org/Bryant Park. And congratulations, Jill. Well deserved.
This is NPR.
Here's some other major headlines we're following today. FBI agents have concluded their search for the deadly poison ricin at the home and storage units near Salt Lake City, Utah. An agency spokesman would not say whether agents found anything relating to the discovery of ricin in a Vegas hotel room last month, but he did say that all of Utah locations they searched are safe.
We have not discovered anything at this time that we are willing to talk about, and of course we still are emphasizing that there is no threat, no public safety hazard.
FBI spokesman Juan Bercera, courtesy of KUTV. 57-year-old Roger Van Bergendorf lived in the home that was searched until about a year ago.
And Israeli troops pulled out of the Gaza Strip today. We'll have more on that story coming up. You are listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
This is NPR.
That's your block of news for this Monday, March 3rd. Stay with us here at the BPP. A couple spending 1,000 days at sea. We'll talk to one of them shortly.